I use this.
This is the second course I taught in college. Oh, 21 at this time. No, sure.
I presume you learned something since then.
These are my notes from that original class.
It's impressive.
Is it some of the magnifying glass?
I can actually do it with my glasses, but I find it easier to just go like this.
Lately, that's what I do as well. Pretty much anything involving non-enlarged text.
Very first day. Anybody still have them here? This is the front of it.
I don't remember.
Well, pass it down maybe two weeks to Lafana. We would have made more.
Probably it was Ezra and Nehemba after Zechariah.
Well, share one.
Certainly after Chag and Zechariah start the Nevuahs. Chag is a very short book of just a matter of months, right?
Right, okay, but then Ezra and Nehemiah came, they prophesied during the same time?
After.
So they're claiming...
Malachi is after.
They claim that after Haggai and Zechariah, Ezra and Nehemiah came back, everything wasn't really fixed yet.
Right. Haggai and Zechariah gave prophecies about what Ezra and Nehemiah would do.
Okay.
And Malachi... is much later than Chag and Zechariah. In fact, Malachi, according to some, was Ezra. Have one more? Richard?
Who was that?
Is somebody else?
The first Targum, say from Malachi, says, this is the prophecy of Malachi, who was Ezra. It fits, by the way. Almost every major point made by Malachi is found in Ezra. There are only really four major points of Malachi. Very short book. It's all found in Ezra. Okay. Now, of course, every Beis Midrash has to have a chiddush. My chiddush to you will be, I'm revealing it to you now, is that while what I did last week with you, which was to divide all of Zechariah's prophecies into six different types of interpretations, right? And we said that it'll be rather impossible to explain every single one of his visions, to give all six of these, right? And that it may be just as impossible to explain all 13 of his visions with one of them consistently, right? Although to explain all 13 of them as some contemporary message, remember what Ibn Ezra tries to do, is probably the easiest thing to do, is to try to figure out what are these horses, what are these colors, why four, what do they represent in his time. And unless we have a very good picture of that time in history, right, we will be very hard-pressed to explain what this prophecy meant to its contemporary listeners. And even if we do have a very good picture of that history, its historical time, how are we to know that it represents this part of the history and not that part of the history? Right? Again, I point to you, Abarbanel Derech, is to show that each one of these is only understood through the unfolding of history. Right?
It's the same today. Why can't they use those prophecies today?
And at the Nami. Some people do. So, I think there's an excellent proof to Abravanel's thesis. Because Zechariah, in chapter 3, refers to a menorah with an everlasting source of oil, where God tells that prophet, this menorah will never run out of oil. You will fight a war and win, not with your might, but with my spirit. And he rails against the assimilation of that period. Now, this is 300 years before Hanukkah that he's saying these things. So, just as, here's the argument, just as this prophecy does not really make sense until it unfolds in the Hanukkah story, so too, why not say the same thing about some of the other prophecies of Zechariah, maybe even some that unfolded hundreds and hundreds of years after the Hanukkah story? I present to you the position of Abarbanel.
But they never, okay? That prophecy never came really to fruition. The one like the Hanukkah story. I mean, they never.
Well, never-ending source of oil means that even when you feel that the oil is running out, I'll find some for you, either to someone finding it in a place they didn't expect to find it, covered with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, either through some miracle. But the main point here is that prophecy has all of the underpinnings of the Hanukkah story, and no secret here. It happens to be the Haftorah of Shabbos Hanukkah, right? We're going to lay in it in a few weeks, right? So I think all I'm just trying to make sense of some of the lesser known prophecies. It's the only one that's Haftorah, right? In the vision part. All right, so let's read the first vision and do our best. We may get stuck. We may. The Hebrew is easy enough. Okay. So let's see. The visions begin in chapter 1, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Zayin. Okay.
Biyomer
Esrim Ba'arba La'Ashtei Asar Chodesh Hu Chodesh Shvat. The 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Shvat, in the second year of Darius, Hayadvar Hashem El Zechariah Ben Berechiah Ben Ido HaNavi Lemor. This word came to Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Ido, the Navi, saying. Now, let me just read to you, give to you the Abarbanel. In fact, the Abarbanel I want to express is actually in these sources here. You can find it on page 11. Can you look at the pasuk I just read and ask a few questions based on the symmetry to other parts of this book? Especially if you're looking at like the whole page, as I think in your Tanakh you have it from the first pasuk, right? And be as just nitpick as much as you want, because that's the derech of Abarbanel. Should I get you started?
Which page is it in?
11. I'll get you started. Why in the beginning of the Sefer does he only mention the number of the month, right?
Without the day.
Without telling you the name of the month. Mm-hmm. And here he tells you the name of the month. Right? Why in both places does he mention not only his father, but he also mentions his grandfather? Did Nevi'im do that? No other Navi does that. Except Sanya, by the way, but that's another thing. But no, Nevi'im just don't do it. Tenuos don't do this. Yeshua ben Amot. You don't Yeshua ben Amot ben someone else. Why does he do this? Okay.
To establish his pedigree for the audience.
Good. I mean, what? Usually, Hayadvar Hashem El Zechariah would have been enough after you just told me who your father and grandfather is. Right? Mm-hmm. It's unusual to mention your grandfather to begin with, and it's more unusual after you've already introduced yourself. I mean, for instance, after Yeshayahu is called Yeshayahu ben Amot in the first pasuk in the Sefer, that name never appears again. Mm-hmm. throughout the book. He's called Yeshayahu from then on.
Yecheskel
ben Buzi. Yecheskel's not a good writer because Yecheskel is hardly ever mentioned in his book. Yecheskel is like Moshe and Devarim. He speaks in first person.
Does he mention his grandfather to somehow connect himself to the time before the destruction?
Someone's grandfather is usually about 70 years old. I don't know, but someone's grandfather saw the earlier, the Beis HaMikdash 68 years ago. Okay, let's give testimony to that. Good.
Didn't you say that it might be referring to this? You go on and you're just skipping some generations along the way?
There was another Navi named Edo. Actually, the Baba Noah claims that it is the same Edo. Skipping generations. Okay. And especially since most Nevi'im will just tell you, if they do care to tell you the month of their prophecy, like Chagai and Zechariah do, they don't tell you the date of the prophecy. Right? Right? Okay, so let's see what this is all about. Okay, do you remember in Chagai the day that they set the stone for the foundation of the Beis HaMikdash? 24th of Kislev, remember? And what date is this? 24th of Shvat. Okay.
2 months later.
That's 59 days apart. Anyone recognize that year? The amount of time? Well, Abravanel uses certain Greek sources to say that 59 years after the Persian conquest of Babylonia was the Greek conquest of Persia. Okay, I'm not sure exactly where he gets that, but he says, I have the Cheshbon here. Modai and Parash ruled us 19 years before the Churban, before the Beis HaMikdash was built, and then 40 years after the Beis HaMikdash was built. Then Alexander the Great came to conquer the Persians. Now, those years might work out well according to, you know, the new Cheshbon. Let me just ask you, what year was the first Beis HaMikdash destroyed? BCE years, please? 586. You all said that, right? That's what I learned in high school.
Right.
If you go now to learn in Jewish high schools, they'll give you a very different date. You familiar with that? They'll give you a date 432, I believe they'll give.
Well,
and
early in the 15th century.
Right.
They'll give
you something like 432 for this destruction, or even a little later than that, and they'll give something like 352 or 362 for the rebuilding. Okay, 59 years later is just about Alexander the Great's time. From Alexander the Great, we have very good time records. We know he came to Yerushalayim in the year 311 BCE. Every year from then on is well accounted for in Staros, in Ksuvus. We have it. We know because it's called Minyan Staros. I have a Ksuv in my office, written about 300 years ago, and the date on it is the date 21 something. 21 what? Is it the year 2100 and something, like we count here? From what? Because Jews were always counting. This is in the Gemara, Maseches Gittin. They used to write in Gittin the date, the year from the date Alexander the Great came to Israel. Wow. Known as Minyan Staros. I'm not making this up. I mean, Alexander the Great's arrival to Israel was like a turning point, like CE, Christians count BC. So we have very good records of that. And what I'm trying to say is Abravanel's Cheshbon of Alexander the Great coming 59 years after the Churban works. I'm sorry, 59 years after the Persians came to town. Okay, which in itself was 51 years after the Churban. All right, it works very well with this new approach to the amount of years. Where does it come from? It comes from a Gemara that in the Sechas of Avodah Zarah that says that the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. which is untenable if you use 586 and 516, because we know the second one was destroyed 68. Right? Many people give 70, but 68 is the correct year. We know it was destroyed in 68, and therefore that's 516 and 68 is a whole lot more years than 420. There's your 584, right? The difference between 584 and 420 is 164. There are 164 missing years. Because if you don't have these 164 missing years, then I'll tell you some other very important ramifications. We are not in 5766 then. We are in 5766 plus 164. If you still want to use 586 as your date.
Then there are still disputes about when time could take place. And so everything can't be. You said it after Alexander the Great, you should know exactly when everything else happened, but there are still some disputes between different.
Based on those two different dates themselves, yes, indeed. Okay. So now here's what I place before you. Shvat is the name of a month. Okay, not used yet. These prophets are only using numbers to name the months. Out of nowhere, Zechariah uses the word Shvat. We've never heard it before. We take it for granted there's something called Tu B'Shvat, but the biblical reader is hearing this name for the first time. Right? These names came out of Bavel. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, the word Shin Bet Tet also means something else in Hebrew. In fact, it's a very common word used by Yeshayahu to describe God's wrath. Shevet Apo. Shvat means the rod of God's anger.
Okay.
Shevet Apo. Okay. God's anger, this is all of Barbara now. This is actually, can you read some of it? You see, I have it underlined. Do you see? How many days is it from Haggai's prophecy of the Beis Hamikdash being founded and this vision? 59 days, right? 59 days to give a hint to the 59 years of the Persian Empire. See, the Persians were at first very kindly disposed to us. Every king of Persia mentioned in Tanakh are Artaxasta, Daryavesh, Koresh, all very good to us. Even Ahasuerus to some extent, although he turned on us. But you know what? Even Koresh turned on us. The kings, the Persian kings, turned on us. They gave in to the pressure of the masses of Persians who thought that the Jews were a fifth column, who were not interested in Persians. We talked about Haman. Haman led a group called Sarei Yehuda. That group is found in Ezra and Nehemiah, and he's called Sorer Yehudim and Esther. Right? So, like the canard that has been mentioned everywhere since, even as Jews are building up every country, right, and saving the lives of their kings, and reporting the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar and Paro and saving everyone around them, right, Jews are always rising to the very top, but it doesn't sit well with the populace. So, here too, the Persian kings were pressured to change their minds. In fact, one of the visions of Zechariah is often used to blame one of the reasons why the Persians turned around against the Jews. One of Zechariah's visions proclaims the governor of Israel as a king. And remember, Haggai had to be very careful not to refer to him as a king, but as a chotam. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the Persians are not going to take kindly to the Jews considering that they have a king above them. The king is Persian. Right? So we'll see that when we get to that prophecy. At this rate, we won't get to it too soon. But let's take a look. The questions are all on the first column. So now we'll go to look at some of the answers, which is in the second column, where it says, you see, it says, Shaitan nebuato zot shnayim chodoshim shlamim miyom liyom. Now I'm on the first underlined line that I put on page 11. I'm going to point to it on my page. I'm right here.
That's the second column.
Not that 11. 11 in my handwriting at the bottom of the page.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you. Alright. He said that he counted two full months, day to day, achari sheyusad hechal Hashem, after the foundation of the Beis HaMikdash, that Chagai mentioned at the end of his book, not coincidentally the day before Hanukkah, Shem Tisha v'chamishim yom, altogether 59 days, k'mispar ha-shanim sheyatmid malchut parash ad sof yamei Daryavesh. The amount of years, one day for every year, a hint to the 59 years of the kingdom of Persia. Matov amru chodesh shvat, and that's why he referred to Shvat by name. Sheid b'zeh sh'ra'ah b'nevuato inyan Alexandros Mokdom, shehaya hashevet hamakeh b'poras. And he's giving a hint to Alexander the Great. Does anybody know the mythology of Alexander the Great, how he became king? What did he do in his youth to deserve to become king? Everyone saw him and says, yes, he's the... I mean, his father was Philip, and...
A horse,
correct. He tamed this huge horse that is killing everybody. Okay? You want to see what the first vision is about?
Where
his father was the king, he was...
Tamed the horse. Look at his first vision, and he sees. I'm just going to read Pasuk Ches for a minute. Ra'isi halayla v'hinei ish rochev al sus adom, who made ben hadashim asher kamtzula v'charav susim adumim shukim ulvanim. I saw in the night a man riding on a red horse. Red is probably brown, right? He's standing amongst the myrtles, Asher Bamtzula, that were in the marsh. And then there were different kinds of horses. Adumim means other red or brown horses. Sukim means striped, and Luvanim means white. Okay, horses. Alright, okay, let's come back to our Rabbah now. Ubavur Shahison Nebuasoro Mezes Laoso Malchus. And because he is giving a hint to the Persian dynasty being finished off by Alexander the Great, Omar b'shnas shtayim l'dayavesh ki olav hayu hadvarim ubiyamav nechrava malchuso v'nizkar kol ze b'kitzer b'mizos v'pishayu tachas memshelas paras. He could not outright talk about the fall of Persia to Alexander the Great while the Persian kings are still around, so he had to couch it within hints in his book for us to read years later. For I saw sakana rabba b'pirsum nevuas korbano. There's a great sakana. Why? How did Daniel get away with speaking to Nebuchadnezzar about the fall of Babel? I mentioned it last week. How did Daniel foretold the fall of Babel to Nebuchadnezzar? How did he get away with it?
Because he knew, he was able to know the dream.
Because he knew, yes, because he told him the dream. That's why if Nebuchadnezzar had remembered the dream, he'd have killed Daniel for that kind of interpretation. Right? When the king says a dream, you better interpret it for good. But Daniel had a free hand. I mean, that was Hashgacha Pratis. Nebuchadnezzar forgot the dream altogether. And he threatened all of his dream interpreters with death if they don't tell him the dream and the interpretation. The Medrash says that they actually were thinking of making up a dream, and then he told them, don't make up any dreams, I'll know what it's not. Right? So when Daniel tells him the dream that my God just revealed to me to tell you, Nebuchadnezzar immediately lit up and said, that's totally my dream, I remember it all now. So at that point, he's so impressed with Daniel and his ability to pick up on the dream that he's willing to hear whatever he says about the dream. Probably very impressed that this man has the chutzpah. Right? I just made one. Nebuchadnezzar just made one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Right? Remember Nebuchadnezzar's
hanging gardens.
Right. So I believe it's at the in the front in the Empire State Building. That big picture. Mm-hmm. Right. So the So he had the chutzpah to talk to me this way. But Zachari does not have this luxury here in Persia, right? So you can't do that. So clearly, right? So it says Shakana Rabba Pirsum Nevuas Korbano. This is a typo. This printed edition just wrote the line twice, right? This is in the Sefer in the Barbanel. Right. And that's why he's using the months that he took him from Babel, because the word Shvat gives a hint to Shevet, to the punishment against them for turning against us. The Persians went back on their word to us. Okay. All right. Now, I'm going to turn away from the Barbanel for the moment and just tell you that I mean, I started to hint to you last time. I think I started to hint to you this when we did in Chagai, when God said, in just a little bit, I'm going to make a huge upheaval in this world. So I spoke already a few times about the upheaval that's going on in the world now, where there is when the Greeks come to town, there's going to be an appreciation for art, for beauty, for knowledge, right? It will be different than all other of the non-Jewish pursuits in the ancient world. They were mostly interested in being Philistine, if you know what I mean. The world was very primitive then when it came to us being able to enlighten them with our holy word, right? But now you have people who might be open to listening to such a thing. If only you'd be the proper Kiddush Hashem. So this is a Rabbanel's derech, that every vision has something to tell us about this new world order where you have a chance to make your presence felt. Okay? And by the way, doesn't it make perfect sense now with the Haftorah we read on Sukkot from the end of Zechariah, where he invites all the Gentiles into the Sukkah, and come live with us in peace, and we'll have an eschatological vision together. It fits perfectly, really. Mm. Right? Okay, so needless to say, this man and this horse is, according to Abravanel, a hint to Alexander the Great. Let's look at some of the interpretations of it. And I'm just going to do one last point on this same page. Just if you don't mind, on this same page, where Yirmiyahu, this is source one on this page, at the top of the page, he tells the people, you are going to be away from your land for 70 years, but before you leave, I want you to do a few things. This is what Perek Lamed Aleph, Lamed Beis, they're all Haftorahs, by the way. Lamed Aleph, Lamed Beis, Lamed Gimel, Dalet, these are all Haftorahs, three or four Haftorahs right in there. Lamed Aleph is the Haftorah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Lamed Beis is the Haftorah of Parshas Bahar. Talks about buying back a piece of land, right? That the Babylonians are about to take from us, right? So you know, Yirmiyahu is buying land. What Yirmiyahu is told to do in chapter 32 is tantamount to a Jew buying up all of Gush Katif the day before the disengagement. Mm-hmm. Right? You're getting out of here anyway. What are you buying the land for? But don't worry, we're coming back. Indeed, when we come back, that's chapter 32. Chapter 34 talks about letting all the slaves free. That Torah process. Mishpatim. Right? A very sad book. Yirmiyahu has a lot of Haftorahs. Okay. So, look what Yirmiyahu does. Hatzivi lach tziyunim. Set up markers for yourself. Simi lach tamrurim. Shishi li beich lam shila derech halacht. Look for tamarim means directions. Shishi libeich la mesila, put your heart to the road, like mesila sisharim, the path. Derech halach, to the path you leave. In other words, as they march you out of Israel, take some rocks on the road, put up little signs here, put up little markers, arrows, whatever it is, so that you can tell your grandchildren on the way back. Shuvi b'salash Yisrael, shuvi al arayach eva. You will come back to these cities. How long are you going to disappear, you rebellious daughter? God is going to create a new thing in the land. The woman shall encircle the man. Wow. What does this mean? First of all, the reason why a chassan stands in the middle and is encircled by his collar seven times is from this pasuk. Nikiva to Soviet Gover. Okay. All right. And the Malbim says something quite amazing here.
What's the real connection?
Why? Because all over Yirmiyahu, this prophet has been telling Jews, no one's going to want to get married. No, things are going to get so bad, you're not going to want to get married. In this chapter, he says, "Od Yishama Be'ore Yehuda, Chutzos Yerushalayim, Kosos Hamas." People want when they want to get married again, it's a sign of the Geula. Right? So, but now, what does the man and woman represent? It is, according to most Meforshim, like Rashi, the woman is Israel, the man is God. Up to now, I've been encircling you. I've been chasing after you. I've been running after you. I've been, right? Remember the story in Shir HaShirim, where he knocks at the door and she's in bed and he goes, and use the same word. Zodi chomak avar. Very unusual word, chomak, in both places. You see it? It's kamokin. See it? She says, my beloved, the woman is just my beloved, the man disappeared. Right? So God is saying to us, according to Rashi, I've chased after you long enough. Now you're going to have to chase after me. Right? Okay. The Malbim mother says it's different. The Malbim says that the man and the woman are not God and his people. The man and the woman, get this, are the land of Israel and the people of Israel. The woman is the land of Israel, the man is the people of Israel. What does it mean? Malbim, right on the side, the source number two. He says that the man usually has to kovesh the land, right? Kovesh woman. The man has to look for his rib, right? He has to go find it. She's not going to present herself to him. He's got to go court her, right? In most traditional areas, the man is the one who does the calling, right? Anyway, so Malbim says that usually when a country goes into a land, they have to do some kind of kibush, like in the time of Yoshua. But now I'm making a new thing in the land. Make markers, because these Babylonians are marching you out. The Persians will allow you in without kibush. The woman will encircle you. The land will come beckoning to you. Right? The Malbim writes this, and he says, in the future, I think so also, that we'll come back to Israel. He's writing this in the 1860s. In the future, you will come back to Israel without a war. And indeed, the United Nations recognized the partition, but the Arabs didn't think that the Malbim was right.
Right? Well, the war was after we came back.
Okay, so, however, I would like to show. If you go back to Pasuk Chaf, Hatzivi Lach Siyunim, what can you think of a modern Hebrew word that fits what Yirmiyahu is trying to say? Of course, Zionism. What is Tziyun, right? What is a Tziyun, a marker, right? What does it mean to be a Zionist? It means to be Mitzuyan about something. Mitzuyan means outstanding. I can see it from far. What is the Tziyunut?
How do you say a mark in Hebrew?
That's a marker. Right. That's what Mitzuyan means, a mark.
A mark.
A perfect mark.
Isn't it used also for graves?
Yes. Absolutely. Tziyun Karot. Absolutely.
It's also graves.
Absolutely.
As well,
the same thing you do for grave, do for here in Israel. A Zionist is someone who feels that I have put a marker there and always set my sights on coming back to this marker. Rashi actually apparently holds that the only type of Zionism is religious Zionism. Because Rashi is Perish Shal Torah, you have to know where, it's in Devarim, and the Pasuk is Samtem Israel Alavavchem, Rashi says that we have to always keep our sights on the mitzvahs to make sure that that when we get to Israel, we know exactly the mitzvahs, what to do, the proper markers to do mitzvahs. Shnemar Hatzivi Lach Tziyunim. Rashi would say that the markers are actually mitzvahs, the mitzvahs that we can only do in Israel. right? I think there's a mistake in that. Rashi says that Solomon was lizards, but I think he meant Trumas and Mises. Anyway, so these are the background sources to our discussion here. Let's go see if we can do something with the first vision. Okay, I'm looking at the vision of the night. I see a man riding on a red horse, standing amongst myrtles in the marsh. Wow. After him are coming red, striped, and white horses. Did they say striped? Sometimes some say orange, maybe?
Sorrel, it says. Yeah.
What color?
Sorrel.
Sorrel? You too?
Sorrel.
S-O-R-R-E-L.
Wow. Good travel word. Okay.
It's a collar. For a horse.
Okay. So let's take a look at Zechariah's reaction to seeing this. Va'omar, ma'ila adoni. And I said, what is this? Remember, last week there was a man of God, an angel, who was directing him. What is all this? Va'yomer Eliyah malach hadover bi, ani areka, I will show you. Ma'hei ma'ila, I will show you what these are. Okay. So, what impression do you get right away from Pasuk Tes? Yeah?
Why is Dover used in that?
Dover is a quiet, Dover is binyan kal as opposed to binyan kal.
As opposed to Medaber, which is stronger.
Medaber is stronger than Dover. Dover is an unusual form. Yeah, we have it very few times in the Torah. That's why the bear of Enikosos, but that bear is a harsh language. It may be to teach that the teacher was saying so softly to him, come, let me show you. Alright? So, what we establish right away is that Zechariah is as confused about these visions as we are.
Mm-hmm.
Alright? What do you expect Zechariah to, I mean, he's in a state of a reverie. And we expect him to have the full faculties to be able to figure out right away what this means.
Mm.
Right? You know what I'm saying? Right? So he's as perplexed as we are, and the man answers, Vayana Isha Omeid Bena Hadassim Vayomar.
Now, the Hadassim we use on Sukkot?
The myrtles, yes, but it's interesting that Chazal connected more to Esther, who is called Hadassah, but they did not connect this to Sukkot. But you see, the reason why I'm telling you this is because, for all we could have appreciated, we could have skipped Pasuk Tes in Yud, or at least Pasuk Tes. In other words, we could have had the vision of a man standing amongst the myrtles saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we have to interject with Zechariah asking, "What are these? What am I looking at here?" And he goes, come, let me tell you. And then the man starts speaking. Just have the man start speaking.
Maybe yes. He wants to impress the people, and like I said, he's really a prophet. So he's not going to just sit there with this. He knows it would be totally things are over.
Okay. We saw that with Haggai quite a bit, right? Right? Okay, so let's see what the man says, Dora and Pasuk Yud. Vayan Ha'ish.
Vayan Ha'ish, who may ben Vayan Ha'adasi in Vayomar. Ela, Sher Shalach Hashem, his Halech Bo'oritz.
Okay. These are the ones that God has chosen to go out into the land.
Interesting that he's spoil and cowl and he has no peel. But look at all this whole mix up of all the banyanim.
That's interesting. Let's see. There's another spoil in the next passage. So let's finish this prophecy and the prophecy will end, well, at least the vision will end. Well, the vision certainly has commentary on it for a while.
Right?
But I'm going to end it and the prophecy itself in the next passage. So she'll just do it for the pleasure of it all.
Vayanu malach Hashem ha'omei bein ha'adasim yom hishalachnu ba'aretz v'hinei kol ha'aretz yushebes v'shokotes
Okay. Yeah. Now, who's speaking here?
Who are the
people? How many human beings are in this vision?
Two. Seems like two.
There was at least and Mother Hadassim.
There's one man standing on the riding on a red horse amongst the Hadassim, right? And there are other horses following him. Now Zachariah is saying, what are all these things? And is he speaking to the man on the horse, or she's speaking to the angel who's sort of directing him, right?
Seems to be.
The angel talking to me said, come, I'll show you what all these mean. The man standing, he saw me, Ben Hadassim.
So he saw, because the man before was on a horse, this mm-hmm. is a man standing. Those are the same man, or is it?
These are the ones that God has sent around the land. Then, Vayanu es malach Hashem ha'omeid bein ha'adasim. Who's answering here?
Was it the horse who was standing in the water, or the man?
The horse at first was standing in the marsh.
Yeah, the man. There was a man riding upon a horse, right?
No, there are two different opinions.
This is really getting very strange. Now the Hebrew is difficult for us, right?
Yeah. Is it the horses who are speaking to the angel, or is it men on the horses implied?
Okay, I'm going to check your Bikias now. Where else in Tanakh does someone say, I have been traveling through the land?
Satan, you know.
Excellent, Stanley. You would probably think I could Stanley all the edges of the forehead.
Who?
He knows the question.
Satan and Eov in Perek Aleph of Zion. Hashem asked to Satan, where are you coming from? He goes, I've been in Shalachti Ba'aretz. I've been going around the land, checking up on things. All right? Only here he says, V'nei kol ha'aretz yosheves v'shukates. How many times in history can you describe that, huh?
No.
Well, you know when we could? When the Persians were in charge. Things were quiet. Okay? So, this is he's saying at this point things are, you know, we're going around with... But Alexander the Great also had things pretty quiet until he died and left over the lands into three hands. We're going to see all about that in these visions, the three divisions of the world. But for now, we're just this is a relatively easy prophecy. Okay, we have the man on the horse who Abarbanel says is Alexander the Great. Okay. Now, the questions that you might have is, did the angel actually show Zechariah what these things mean? Because Zechariah doesn't really tell us what it means, right? Do we have to imagine, Ezra Adak and others say, even Ezra, that what Zechariah did when he woke up from this vision was he shared a long message about what this means to the people? Right? There is going to be peace and tranquility in this world, and we will have an opportunity to make our presence felt in it. Okay? We can never defeat the Persians or the Greeks, but what we can do, and it's a terrible shame that we never ended up doing this, it's Christians who ended up doing this. Christians didn't defeat the Romans, Christians converted the Romans. Right?
The Jews should have done the same thing.
The Jews should have been able to do the same thing beforehand. Right? Okay, so
Rabbi, what do you think of the use of the word "mihitalech" to walk in the land rather than to settle the land, to conquer?
Mihitalech means to go back and forth.
Is it a threat?
No, I think it just means coming all around. Going up and down.
There's no threat.
Policing the land.
Is that the word?
It's interesting. In each one of these psukim, including this one, I believe, and certainly the one in Eov, there's something menacing about it. It's something hovering and passing around, you know, going all around. You know, like All right, so in this case, policing everything or making sure that no one steps out of line.
Could it mean conquering? It's like the conquest of the world. Now everything is at rest and still. Walking to and fro, it's going from one country to another.
Mm-hmm. Right. Satan. Now, a lot of Abarbanel's interpretation connecting this to Alexander the Great comes from Josephus. Josephus has quite a bit. I don't know how many of you have read straight Josephus, but he has quite a bit about Alexander the Great and the Jews. Alexander the Great, by the time of Josephus, and I must say, in our Talmud, because he's mentioned quite a lot in Masechet Sanhedrin, and especially Masechet Tamid, the end of Masechet Tamid. A lot of Agadot, never mind the Midrashim, that speak very highly of Alexander the Great. The Horaya, I don't know too many Socrateses and too many Demosthenes and Aristophanes, but there are lots of Alexanders, down to our very day. Not to mention the Alexander Rav. Right? There's a Hasidus called the Alexander Hasidim. Right? So, what kind of name is that? That's a holy Greek name, for goodness sakes.
And other people
took names
like Antigonus.
Well, not to this day, I don't think.
They didn't name their children Alexander.
Right, of course. I know two brothers, Darius and Cyrus.
I don't know Cyrus.
But Alex,
Cyrus,
Alex is a popular name.
Mm-hmm. Even amongst the firmest of the Hasidishim.
You usually call him
Sander,
right?
Sander. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just did a wedding for someone. His name was Alexander Sander. His middle name was Sander. Okay. All right, so therefore, Alexander is the one standing amongst Hadassim. Now, of course, Abravanel will just use, as the Midrashim do, that the Hadassim are tzaddikim, righteous people. Why? Must be righteous. We use it for a mitzvah on Sukkot. Besides, it's the name of a righteous woman. Tosfos points out some circular reasoning, by the way, that the Gemara does. Because in one Gemara, where the Gemara says that Esther's name is Hadassah, and we see that Hadassah is such a righteous name because, see the Hadassah in here. Right? And in another Gemara it says, these must be righteous men because, see, Hadassah, Esther was named Hadassah. So Tosfos does that, and he says it's a kasha, and Tosfos says, yeah, but the Gemara does this a few other times. Uh-huh. Gemara says that Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basadeh. How do you know that Lasuach Basadeh means the Davin? Right.
Well,
he might see. So he quotes the pasuk elsewhere because he says, "Lifnei Hashem yishpoch shicho." Then there's another gemara that quotes that pasuk and says, "How do you know that he's davening there?" Because it says, "Ve'ete yitzchak l'suach pasadeh." So, I don't know. It's the pasuk in Tehillim itself, I think, stands on its own. He says davening, but be it as it may, this first prophecy was meant to teach the following. There is quiet in the land. Actually, the quiet that he's referring to, according to Abarbanel, is the quiet that Alexander is going to bring. Okay, Alexander will bring a conquest, which will bring tranquility to the land. And he says that there's good news.
That word, using fete, quiet in the land. Could be interpreted in many ways. It could be tranquility, but it also could be that there is quiet in the sense that people are afraid to speak, they're afraid to protest.
Good point.
It also could be submission. So I'm when I saw that, I was wondering really what that meant. I'm glad you explained it.
But
you think it was tranquility?
I believe so. I mean, the Targum says shleva ushkita because it says shalva. The Targum reads shleva, shalva. Now, it's true that there might not be too much dissent in some very, very repressive country. I don't know if there's too much dissent in North Korea. I'm quite sure there's more dissent in America than in North Korea. You can't judge a country's success based on the amount of descent. That's for sure not. But at the same point, this pasuk, I believe, but it's certainly worthwhile to bring it up. But I don't believe that that is the that's the sentiment of the pasuk. Nor do I believe that that is what history has told us about the kingdom of Alexander the Great. I'm sure that you couldn't go up to the palace and throw a pie in the king's face, but in other words, I'm sure you don't have the kind of dissent that you can have in this country against your president, right? And get away with it. I'm sure you couldn't do that back then either. You couldn't do that back then at the time. But at the same point, I would have loved to see what is usually the targum to the word shoketes. Sheket by Tishoket is ushadoches. Actually, the word shidduch, which many people think is Yiddish, is actually not Yiddish, it's Aramaic. Right? The word shindalat chof is the targum, the Aramaic translation of sheket. Okay, we don't see it here, I'm not sure why. But it's a type of menucha. Remember when Naomi told Ruth, I want you to find a husband, she said, go and find menucha. Right? Isha beis isha. Right, so it gives, you know, like a, let's say menuchas hanefesh, to find that sheket, mm-hmm. that shalva, so to say. But
and what does menucha do with quiet?
I don't mean to say with tongue in cheek, but it's meant to, you know, to quiet down your restlessness. I don't know. I just, but the point here is I have no proof other than what history tells us. That in the time of Alexander the Great, people were mostly submissive to his kingdom. But a sure sign of repressiveness at that time, like let's say with Antiochus, is how did he treat his Jews? Right? Alexander the Great came to Yerushalayim in the year 311 with an image of himself to put in our temple, and somehow, I mean, the Gemara tells it amazingly. Right? You know, says that he saw the Kohen Gadol and started bowing down to him, and his one of his generals said, "What are you bowing down to this Jew for?" He goes, "I can't believe this. He was in my dream last night. I had dreamed this man in his white clothes, and he came in my dream and told me, give me some advice." And Alexander was very much like that. You know, he based whole campaigns on little omens he saw, you know, little star he saw, something like that. Right? And then from that, and he was just calmly disposed towards the Jews. Our Talmud, our Midrashim tell other stories about how Shimon HaTzadik and convinced him of certain things, and the parting words where Alexander said, "I know long after my name is forgotten that the Jews will still be keeping their rituals, because we only remember our conquests. The Jews remember their losses," because he was Tisha B'Av and he was crying for the Korban. Alright, so
sorry. On the other hand, the next pasuk is one of exhortation to action. Mm-hmm. Ad matai.
There's
this silence, and mm-hmm. then it's followed by where I lost my place. Vayana malach Hashem v'yom ravei sa'ot ad matai atal lo tzuratem et Yerushalayim v'yet arei Yehuda and asher za'amta zeh hivim shema. So, mm-hmm. so I feel that's having read that following pasuk, I thought maybe the concept of sheket was more submissiveness. They weren't doing anything about the 70 years that had passed. Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, remember one thing: the shevet sheketes is not describing something now; it's describing something 40 plus years from now. So. But I just want to leave you with one thought, is that this angel is doing something angels don't usually do. Angels don't usually challenge God. The prophets will challenge God.
He's having a debate.
Right, saying, how long are you going to not have pity on Yerushalayim? Yeah. Come on, the 70 years are almost over. Right? Less than 2 years to go. So the angel is switching gears right now, right? We've been talking at first, at least according to Rabbi Manel, about some kind of story that's taking place in the future, some 40 years from now, right? Okay. So if we're talking about Alexander the Great, and we see three streams of horses ever, what is that? The three kingdoms that would emanate from Alexander the Great. You have the Seleucids to the north, You have Ptolemies to the south, and the middle was never really, really decided so well. And you know, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids were fighting up and down, like Shmata going up and down with Israel in the middle, and they were caught between all the wars, right? So Antiochus and the Seleucids and the Ptolemies were generally better disposed towards us. Remember the story of how they commissioned the Bible to be translated into Greek?
Mm-hmm.
Came to be known as the Septuagint. So Alexander the Great is an Ish, and those others are not, they're not sons of man, they're just horses. They were not on Alexander's level. So these three, and what's interesting is, I mean, I have here like some charts of the commentaries to try to show which color represents which kingdom and why. It's possible that if we should go this far, actually, is that the red horses are the bloody horses are the ones that were not good to us. Those are the Seleucids that produced Antiochus, right? The white horses are the ones that were kind to us. That's the Ptolemies. The Middle Kingdom was ruled at first by Antinos, A-N-T-Y-N-O-S, Antinos, and that's the middle kind, the middle horses, whether it's however you saw it or however you pronounce it. Okay, so this is how the prophecies go. I will not be doing each one of the prophecies like a Brabanel, but this is the general derech. Every single one of them is some unfolding of history, starting from the Greek conquest all the way going through history, through the Spanish Inquisition. Are you in for all that?
What do the other commentators say about this prophecy? If you don't read it, that's what Alexander, what does it mean?
That it's, for instance, Rashi speaks about the righteous and the wicked being making your way as righteous, a righteous nation in a wicked world, and having your various streams emanating from you, making sure that it follows near there. I mean, and Rashi generally just tries to explain as well as possible the Aramaic, the Hebrew of Targum Yonasan.
Do you know if this is where the Christians get the idea of the four horsemen of the apocalypse or something?
I think that's in the book of Revelation, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's more of that coming up, by the way. We're not finished with horses. And the number four is going to appear in almost every one of these visions.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the book of Revelation, there's also about four. What is that? Why four?
The four exiles, right?
Four, right? Bavel, Paras, Yavam, Edom. There are all sorts of fours. There are four. There's the Kohen Gadol, Eliyahu HaNavi, Mashiach ben Yosef, and Mashiach ben David.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the four men who are supposed to enact the final case. In our most Torah, we say, Hakeim Lanu Roim Shiva, because in addition to these four, there's supposed to be even three other, pre-messianic figures. Have you heard of that thing? Tomorrow at the end of the Masechet Sukkah, we'll learn all these things are going to come out of Zechariah, right? And I'll tell you this: it's a little premature now, but when I would like to read through all of Ma'oz Tzur, because a lot of Ma'oz Tzur is commentary to Sefer Zechariah. And we'll even a little bit of Chagai. I shouldn't say all of Ma'oz Tzur, of course, because some of Ma'oz Tzur, just the paragraphs about the last two or three paragraphs, some is about Mitzrayim. The Purim story, but the last few paragraphs, Hanukkah and in the future. Okay, all right. So we got past the first vision. We have 13 altogether. We're going to sweat through it. Okay, then the book gets really hard.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Deborah. Wonderful week.
Thank you.
If you want to pass the